Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Marking 1 year since the Taliban took over Afghanistan, on Monday the UN warned about a situation that continues to deteriorate. Over half of the country's population now live below the poverty line, with nearly 23 million food insecure, according to Deputy Special Representative Ramiz Alakbarov. And Afghan women and girls have seen a significant rolling back of their economic, political and social rights and a worrying escalation in restrictive gender policies and behaviours. Without the education, work and freedom of movement, they find themselves increasingly relegated to the margins, Mr. Alakbarov said. Meanwhile, the head of UN Women, Seema Bahous, pointed out that the deliberate slew of measures against Afghan women and girls is also a terrible act of self-sabotage for a country facing huge challenges, including exposure to global economic headwinds. She urged the de facto authorities to open schools for all girls and allow employment for women and their participation in politics. The UN-chartered Brave Commander freighter ship is preparing to leave the Ukrainian port of Yazoon east of Odessa, carrying 23,000 metric tons of grain to Djibouti in East Africa. From there, the grain will be transferred to Ethiopia under the World Food Programme initiative to unblock food shipments following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Last month, Russia and Ukraine reached an agreement with the UN in Turkey to restart Black Sea grain deliveries, which had triggered global food insecurity. Millions of people in Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan and Sudan in particular are facing dramatic food shortages, the UN warned. About a dozen ships have left Ukraine since the July deal, but they had primarily transported corn for animal feed or biofuel rather than wheat for human consumption. Talks resume on Monday between UN member states aimed at finally completing a UN High Seas Treaty for Ocean Protection globally. With two-thirds of the world's oceans outside of any country's territory, the largely unregulated waters face many threats, including overfishing and deep-sea mining. If agreed, 30% of the world's oceans will be put into conservation areas by 2030. After 10 years and four inconclusive sessions, at least 49 countries have committed to achieving a legal treaty and decided in March that a fifth and final session will be convened with the hope of signing the pact by the end of the year. In addition to COVID-19, which had prevented countries from meeting, disagreements have continued over what should be included. At a UN Ocean Conference in June, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres declared an ocean emergency and suggested the egoism of some governments was hampering efforts to agree on a high seas treaty. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a Texas court has told Alex Jones to pay some $49 million in damages for his perverse accusatory talk about the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre being a big hoax. The jury evidently not believing Jones's tale that he was suffering a weird and weirdly profitable psychosis when he told his followers that no one died at Sandy Hook because none of the victims ever existed. Nor were jurors evidently moved by Jones's subsequent claim that he did it all from a pure place. Jones, as the Hearst Connecticut Media Editorial Board noted in a strong statement, is trying to keep any mention of his white supremacy and right-wing extremism out of the Sandy Hook case he's now facing in New Hampshire, because, his lawyer in that case says, that discussion would be unfairly prejudicial and inflammatory, an attack on Jones's character that would play to the emotions of the jury and distract from the main issues. What should be the main issues when our vaunted elite press corps engage a figure like Alex Jones? We'll talk with Angelo Corazon, president of Media Matters. Also on the show, in 1991, on the fifth anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear plant accident, an editorial in the Minneapolis Star Tribune concluded, Despite Chernobyl, nuclear energy is the green alternative. The Houston Post enjoined readers, let's not learn the wrong lesson from Chernobyl and rule nukes out of our future. Corporate news media have been rehabilitating nuclear power for as long as the public has been terrified by its dangers, sometimes as heavy-handedly as NBC in 1987, running a documentary, Nuclear Power, In France It Works, that failed to mention that NBC's then-owner, General Electric, was the country's second-largest nuclear power entity and third-largest producer of nuclear weapons. Now, in Russia's war on Ukraine, we're seeing news media toss the possibility of nuclear war into the news you're meant to read over your breakfast. Has something changed to make the unleashing of nuclear weaponry less horrific? And if not, what can we be doing to push it back off the table and out of news media's parlor game chat? We'll hear from author and journalism professor Carl Grossman. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. A Texas jury levied $45 million in punitive and $4 million in compensatory damages against Alex Jones on behalf of the parents of Jesse Lewis, a six-year-old, one of the 26 people whom Jones insisted to his followers, not once but over and over again, were not shot to death at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012 because they never existed. Their mourning families really paid scammers, faking grief in a ploy to take away gun rights. Responses to the verdict included both reporting calling it a punishing salvo in a fledgling war on harmful misinformation and headlines declaring Alex Jones isn't sorry and won't change. A reflection of the fact that the Alex Jones phenomenon involves more than the particular piece of work that is Jones, but also the array of people who platform and profit from his actions. Angelo Carson has been tracking right-wing media machinery for some time. He is president of Media Matters, and he joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Angelo Carson.
Thank you.
Well, before this trial, as he tried to forestall it, Jones at one point called one of the Sandy Hook family's lawyers, called for the lawyer's head on a pike. And then after the verdict, he was back on his show saying that it was all an attack on him by globalists. Alex Jones learning anything was probably never on the table. But did you learn anything new about Jones or his operations from this trial?
I think we knew that he was making a lot of money. What we didn't know until the trial is that he, and this is, I think, what's really significant about it, is that he's making not just a lot of money, but he's doing some really shady things with it. So, for example, the estimates from their forensic analysis was that he has somewhere between $250 to $300 million in assets. Now, Jones would declare he's bankrupt, but when you start to unpackage that a little bit, what you'll find out is that there's a company which owns a lot of debt to Alex Jones called PKMG. He's the primary owner of it. And starting right when the buzzards started circling around Jones a couple years ago, he began moving tens of millions of dollars, sometimes payments of $50 million, $60 million to this company that now owed Alex Jones a debt itself. So it's pretty interesting. That, I think, is like just the financial part of this is interesting. I think if I were to sum it up, I would say the one thing we learned is that the scale of the revenue that he's made in this period of time, and then also that essentially it really is much more of an infomercial at this point than it is, you know, a traditional type programming.
Well, and you think when journalists are looking at it, follow the money is kind of a prime directive, right? You know, and here that would be very interesting. And then even the, you know, the business plan, if you will, stoke anxiety and then sell survival gear at 100% markup. That's not really a new plan, as it were.
No, it's not. I mean, you know, the part that is interesting is that he's managed to convince and capture the attention of some very significant conservative donors. And that means that he has access to donations. You know, in addition to people buying his products, he solicits donations multiple times a day, a lot of times a day. But, I mean, he's gotten pretty hefty Bitcoin donations from anonymous sources, upwards in the realm of $8 million. He got a big $8 million donation in May, a single one. But he's had other big ones of that scale over the last couple of years. And one of the donations that always jumps out to me is in the lead up to January 6th, this was in November, he was trying to secure a permit for a demonstration in D.C. This is before it was even organized. And somebody gave him a $500,000 donation anonymously so that he could file for the one of the original permits that later ended up getting transferred over for that big January 6th event. So, you know, that part I think is novel and unexplored is just how much people are that are in this orbit are also willing to give him from a donations perspective. And once you get a few of those deep pockets, that gives you a lot of operational capacity.
Well, and my general sense is that you think it's a mistake to focus overwhelmingly on sifting out what's special and specific about Alex Jones at the expense of seeing why and how his playbook, if you will, has been normalized both in the Republican Party and through right-wing media. This is a story where the bigger picture really is the story.
Yeah, I think that's right, actually. If we were to have this conversation 10 years ago, I would say that Alex Jones is sort of an island unto himself. And, you know, occasionally Glenn Beck would steal some of his stuff and sort of launder it and sanitize it a little bit and do it on his Fox News show back then. But he was really sort of on an island unto himself. And one of the things that's different between then and now is that the content that Alex Jones says on a fairly daily basis is essentially mirrored and reflected through establishment Republicans and the traditional right-wing media. So, you know, the deep state notion, which is not controversial anymore, everyone says that on the Republican side, that somehow there's some conspiracy inside government. Even now, more so with the Mar-a-Lago search warrant, that's an Alex Jones conspiracy. And just last night, you know, Fox News was pushing this idea that there was this globalist meeting between Soros and Garland and Biden and all the, and these foreign prime ministers who decided that this was going to be the playbook to take out Donald Trump and subjugate America. That's conspiracy stuff that he's been pushing. And then the last one is, you know, the right-wing media, both talk radio and Fox, they've also been pushing this idea that the evidence was planted inside the safe in Mar-a-Lago. They didn't even know what the evidence, they don't even know what was planted, but they're already conjuring up a conspiracy. So that's very much what Alex Jones has peddled in, and now it is nearly indistinguishable from the traditional, you know, right-wing and conservative talking points. And I think that's the part that's significant about all of this, is that the big players now are doing Alex Jones. Everything is InfoWars. And that's basically what I would say.
You know, I have to say I thought that something would change in 2017 when Jones was in a custody fight with his ex-wife and she said, I don't want my kids around this guy. You know, he's calling for people to have their necks broken. He said he wants Jennifer Lopez to be raped. You know, I just don't want my kids around him. And Alex Jones's lawyer at the time said that Jones is a performance artist, that he's playing a character. And to judge him by what he says on InfoWars, his lawyer said, would be like judging Jack Nicholson by his portrayal of the Joker in Batman. Now, I'm not naive, you know, I've been at this for a minute, but I have to say I was still surprised that after that, media went right back, not just right-wing media, but centrist elite media went right back to calling Alex Jones controversial, calling him bombastic. You know, even now it's weird to read that Jones acknowledges today that Sandy Hook happened, you know, as though we need to credit any particular relationship between what he says and reality. You know, I mean, I guess I hold some blame for not just right-wing media, but so-called mainstream media for not at that point. Once his case was, I don't believe any of this, and you'd have to be stupid to believe anything that I say, why didn't mm-hmm. the picture of him change? Why didn't we start talking about him differently?
And that's the part that I find so frustrating, and I think that it gets back to my, you know, why I do what I do, and why I'm glad you guys exist too, is that, you know, there are some real problems with the way the news media has handled this, and they are reflective of deeper issues. They tend to privilege the right wing in a way that I think is ultimately destructive. And at the moment that he acknowledged that it was all an act, then I think he should be treated accordingly. And I was with you, because at the same time that that story happened, let's not forget that Pizzagate was still fresh
right.
in the minds of so many of the Beltway media. Many of them used to frequent that pizza establishment in Washington, D.C. Alex Jones was one of the big drivers of the Pizzagate conspiracy. It's specifically the establishment that was targeted. And so I thought, to your point, that when he made that argument and said that stuff, and it became so clear that that was his defense, that they would change their narrative because it would be juxtaposed with the reality of the experience that just happened. But it didn't. And Tucker Carlson gets the same pass, right? I mean, Fox News won a lawsuit just 2 years ago, or a little more than that, where their defense was no reasonable person would believe the things that Tucker Carlson says. And yet the news media doesn't talk about him any differently either. And I think that this is part of the inertia that exists in the coverage. But what, in effect, it's not that I encourage them to debunk them all the time, but I do think that what they do is they have a very limited set of boxes that they can apply to individuals, and they very rarely change those. You know, there are plenty of establishment individuals that get quoted, and they're treated as Christian organizations or conservative when, in fact, they're officially designated hate groups, right? So it is a deep problem in the news media that they both don't have the language, and when they do have the language, there's still so much inertia and hesitancy, I think, in shifting their coverage. I think there's a little bit of the right wing working the refs that ends up poisoning the coverage, too, that is a real problem.
Well, I'm going to have to end it there, but we're absolutely going to pick it up again. We've been speaking with Angelo Corazon. He's president of Media Matters. They're online at mediamatters.org. Angelo Corazon, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Seventy-seven years after the devastating atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says, quote, the prospect of nuclear conflict, once unthinkable, is now back within the realm of possibility, close quote. It's being floated by Vladimir Putin as part of his warmongering in Ukraine and slipping with a disturbing lack of friction into media discussion, as when Britain's The Economist runs the headline, A New Era, Why the War in Ukraine Makes Nuclear Conflict More Likely. Has the annihilating power of nuclear weapons changed? Or has the public lost touch with it, in part due to corporate media that include mention of the possibility without talking about how to avoid it? Carl Grossman is professor of journalism at SUNY College at Old Westbury, columnist and author of numerous books, including Weapons in Space and The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. He's a longtime host of the show Enviro Close Up and a board member of the Media Watch Group FAIR. He joins us now by phone from Long Island. Welcome back to Counterspin, Carl Grossman.
A pleasure, Janine.
Is reality different? Are nuclear weapons safer or more containable or somehow less nightmarish than when we feel what we feel thinking about hundreds of thousands of dead men, women, and children in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
It's far worse in terms of the power of nuclear weapons today compared to the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For example, the Ohio-class submarines, which are built just across the Long Island Sound from where I'm speaking on Long Island, built in Connecticut. And I'm just reading here from an account in the National Interest, a middle-of-the-road publication, which speaks of the Trident II missiles on these submarines having the speed when they re-enter the atmosphere of Mach 24, splitting up into 8 independent reentry vehicles with 100 to 475 kiloton nuclear warheads. In short, says the National Interest, a full salvo from an Ohio-class submarine, which can be launched in less than 1 minute, could unleash up to 192 nuclear warheads to wipe 24 cities off the map. This is a nightmarish weapon of the apocalypse. Without being hyperbolic, nuclear war is, it's global suicide. Years ago, Robert Scheer wrote a book with enough shovels, and this was some character who was involved in so-called civil defense, saying, well, with enough shovels, everybody could dig holes in the ground. And I mean, that was ridiculous then. Now it is, the reality is apocalypse.
Right.
And what I pointed to in the piece that I wrote for FAIR is that this very, very important treaty was put together and passed, enacted by the United Nations in 2017. It took force last year. It's called the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and it could put the nuclear weapons genie back in the bottle. In the same way, in the 1920s, chemical weapons were put back after World War I, and it was realized by the world the horrific impacts of chemical weapons, tens of thousands of soldiers killed by mustard gas and so forth. So there was a succession of treaties, and they've not been perfect, but basically chemical warfare hasn't existed the way it could have existed. And the same thing could occur with these nuclear weapons.
Well, why is that treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons? First of all, I think you're going to talk about why many listeners might not have heard about it. But then also, it has a primary difficulty, which is, you know, most of the world is calling for an effort to say never to nuclear weapons, but key players are not.
Yeah, well, it was passed in the General Assembly, this treaty, by over 120 nations, and additional supporters exist today. But the so-called nuclear weapon states, the United States, Russia, China, France, and the United Kingdom, have not signed on, have not ratified this treaty. And without the nuclear weapon states signing on, the treaty, it doesn't provide thus for a ban on nuclear weapons. They're not going to abide by it, and
right.
There we are. As to getting these nations to sign on, I feel that, an organization which involves many peace groups from around the country, the Nuclear Ban Treaty Collaborative, believes that key media, the press, but as the coalition charges, the media are acting like the treaty does not exist. And I think, and this collaborative feels, that if the press would do its work and inform people about the treaty, also about the nature of what nuclear war would mean these days, then maybe these countries could be prodded to sign on to the treaty. And the vision of the United Nations, which it goes way back at, you know, in the UN in terms of abolishing nuclear weapons, it was Treaty 1, Resolution 1 of the United Nations in 1946 to abolish nuclear weapons.
Wow.
But in any case, back to media, they've been asleep. In my piece, we cite the Nexus News database of U.S. newspapers mentioning nuclear weapons over 5,000 times since, this is in February, when Putin began talking about their possible use in Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. And as of last week, only 43 of those times included a mention of the treaty. And the great majority of those 43 times were letters to the editor and opinion columns.
Right. So not straight reporting, not the news reporting, you know, where they're actually talking about the possible use of nuclear weapons. They're not including in the same story where it could be meaningful that there is and has been an effort to prevent this from happening. And you know, Carl, I just want to add, as I know that you've reported, it isn't just that the U.S., and that's where we live, and that's the country that we have our foremost concern with, it isn't just that the U.S. has not signed the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. The U.S. boycotts meetings. The U.S. pressures other countries not to sign. There's a whole lot of story to tell there about the role that the U.S. plays in obstructing, in fact, the world coming together to prevent the employment of these devastating weapons.
Yeah, absolutely. The pressure that's been applied by these nuclear weapon states, actually not just our beloved country, is enormous. What's happening now, instead of abolishing nuclear weapons, is the United States has been involved in a modernization program to build bigger and more deadly nuclear weapons. I mean, we're going backwards. Well, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists really gave us warning. They have this doomsday clock since 1947, and in 2020 it pushed forward to 100 seconds to midnight, which the Bulletin defines as nuclear annihilation. And the following year, 2021, stated, this is the closest it's been to midnight since 47, it stayed at 100 seconds to midnight. And this year, before the invasion, again at 100 seconds to midnight. I mean, in my generation, I think I just finished co-authoring a book, Cold War Long Island, and I was asked by my co-author, Chris Verger, who was a history professor, to join him in writing the book, because I covered as a journalist based on Long Island since 62 many of these issues, how Long Island had all kind of Cold War preparations, nuclear-tipped missile bases to shoot down feared Soviet bombers heading to New York City. And furthermore, in the 50s, as a kid in PS 136 in Queens, where I went to school, they gave all the New York City school kids door kegs to wear, and we did these duck and cover exercises. So here I was writing about all this, and then suddenly, started writing the book a couple of years ago, suddenly we're not only in a new Cold War, but it could become very quickly a hot nuclear war. And the kind of awareness that, I mean, I teach journalism, and my students, not only did they not have the scary experience of wearing dog tags and fearing doomsday, but hardly any of them have seen Dr. Strangelove or even an excellent ABC film the day after about the consequences of nuclear war. Often, the word used these days is that certain things are of existential importance. Mm-hmm. If anything is of existential importance, it's abolishing nuclear weapons and avoiding a nuclear holocaust. And I use that word advisedly. And this collaborative, in addition to the Nexus findings, does an analysis of reporting on the treaty by the New York Times, by CNN, by National Public Radio, and basically they're all out to lunch. They report plenty on issues of, particularly now with Ukraine and Putin threatening and so forth, the possibility of nuclear war, but they don't mention, hey, we got this treaty which can, if the nuclear weapons states would agree, of course, would avoid this horrific nightmare of nuclear war.
We've been speaking with Carl Grossman. His recent piece, Why Is There More Media Talk About Using Nuclear Weapons Than About Banning Them, can be found on FAIR.org. And you can also follow his work on carlgrossman.com. Carl Grossman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
A pleasure, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
John Grant on at the top of the hour. John Grant, I have not been visiting for the last 3 weeks. It's just the pure press of necessity. And the mother of invention, we have been very busy. John Grant will be on at the top of the hour, and we'll discuss the latest current events. And until then, we'll have a little bit of music and Democracy Now. Back in a little bit.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Georgia, prosecutors have informed Rudy Giuliani he's the target of a criminal investigation into interference in the 2020 election. Giuliani is scheduled to appear before a special grand jury in Atlanta tomorrow, where he faces questions about his efforts to keep former President Donald Trump in power. Giuliani led Trump's attempts to overturn the results of Joe Biden's victory in Georgia by more than 12,000 votes. Giuliani repeatedly cited baseless conspiracy theories and led an unlawful effort to put forward an alternate slate of presidential electors. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Georgia has denied a bid by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham to quash a subpoena ordering Graham to testify to the grand jury in Atlanta. Fulton County prosecutors want Senator Graham to explain the reason for two calls he placed just after the 2020 election to Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Republican Secretary of State. Raffensperger told reporters after the calls Graham had hinted he should throw away ballots from areas where Biden likely got more votes.
I asked if the ballots could be matched back to the voters, and then I got the sense it implied that then you could throw those out. And he really would look at the counties with the highest frequent error of signatures. Well, just an implication that look hard and see how many ballots you could throw out.
South Carolina Republican Senator Graham has promised to appeal the order compelling him to testify in court, arguing he's shielded under the Constitution's speech or debate clause. The Justice Department's asked a federal judge not to unseal a sworn affidavit used by the FBI to recover 11 sets of secret government documents from Trump's home in Florida. The affidavit was the basis of an application that convinced a judge to sign off on the warrant used by federal agents in their search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence on August 8th. In a federal court filing, prosecutors said the affidavit contains highly classified material and sensitive information about witnesses, and that its release would compromise the continuing investigation. Voters in Alaska and Wyoming head to the polls today for primary elections. In Wyoming, pro-Trump primary challenger Harriet Hageman is poised to unseat incumbent Congressmember Liz Cheney amidst backlash over Cheney's role as one of two Republicans on the House January 6th committee. In Alaska, former governor and 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin leads a crowded field seeking to fill Alaska's lone U.S. House seat, which had been held by Don Young for nearly half a century before his death in March. Meanwhile, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski faces 18 Republican primary challengers, including pro-Trump candidate Kelly Shabaka. Last year, Murkowski was one of just seven Republican senators who voted to convict then-President Trump after the House impeached him over the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The Biden administration's ruled out releasing roughly $7 billion in foreign assets held by Afghanistan's central bank on U.S. soil. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which reports Biden's decision not to return the funds came after he ordered the assassination of Al-Qaeda's leader in Kabul. This comes as the United States warns a staggering 95% of Afghans are not getting enough food, with that number rising to almost 100% in female-headed households. Earlier this year, Democracy Now! Spoke with Masuda Sultan, Afghan-American women's rights activist.
Human Rights Watch agrees with us. The head of the UN agrees with us. The head of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband, agrees with us. You talk to just about every humanitarian organization, any economist, they will tell you that a central bank's reserves belong in the central bank. But instead, we have just decided that Afghanistan cannot have its central bank reserves, that that economy will now be crippled. We just knocked the legs out of it, and the humanitarian crisis will just grow and grow. Afghanistan will be an aid-dependent country.
Masuda Sultan is founding member of Unfreezing Afghanistan. Ukraine's military says an elite unit operating behind enemy lines was responsible for a massive explosion at a Russian ammunition depot earlier today in the Russian annexed province of Crimea in southern Ukraine. Video shows a huge fireball and smoke rising over a village in northern Crimea near the site of the blast. Russian state media described the explosion as sabotage that damaged civilian infrastructure. This follows another explosion last week at a Russian air base in Crimea, which destroyed as many as 9 Russian warplanes. Elsewhere, a massive United Nations chartered ship carrying more than 23,000 metric tons of wheat has left a port in southern Ukraine bound for Ethiopia. It's the first shipment of food from a Black Sea port in Ukraine since Russia invaded more than 6 months ago. In Kenya, William Ruto has been declared winner of a highly contested presidential election. Kenya's Electoral Commission says Ruto defeated the former prime minister and opposition leader Raila Odinga by a narrow margin, getting just over 50% of the vote. Ruto has been deputy president of Kenya since 2013. His party, the Kenya First Coalition, has also won a majority of seats in Kenya's Senate. At least 4 Kenyan election commissioners said they did not support the results due to the opaque nature of the vote count, as diplomats and international election officials were removed from the tallying hall right before Ruto's victory was announced Monday. Ruto will serve as Kenya's 5th president since its independence from Britain in 1963. He addressed the East African nation Monday.
There is no room for vengeance. There is no room for looking back. We are looking into the future.
In Saudi Arabia, women's rights defender Salma al-Shahab has been sentenced to 34 years in prison over her advocacy. It's reportedly the longest sentence ever given to a Saudi women's rights activist. Al-Shahab was initially sentenced to a 6-year prison term over tweets she posted critical of Saudi Arabia's treatment of women. But an appeals court last week increased the sentence to 34 years behind bars and banned al-Shahab from leaving the kingdom for an additional 34 years. Human rights advocates warn of worsening conditions for Saudi women as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman intensifies his crackdown on dissent. Saudi Arabia's state-controlled oil company has broken its own record after posting a profit of $48.4 billion for the second quarter of 2022. It's the largest quarterly profit ever posted by a publicly traded company, coming as Russia's invasion of Ukraine helped push oil prices up. In Germany, police used batons, pepper spray, and water cannons to attack about 150 climate justice advocates who staged a nonviolent sit-in protest Saturday on a rail supply line leading to the harbor in Hamburg. The protesters are seeking to halt construction of new liquefied natural gas terminals along Germany's coast. This comes as German households face spiraling fuel costs that could see them spend hundreds of euros more per year to power their homes. This is protest spokesperson Charlie Dietz.
In Germany, too, the energy crisis is hitting those hardest who contributed the least, crisis in which many bear the cost, while the few corporations pocket billions in profits. It is explicitly not an energy crisis. It is a capitalist distribution crisis.
Lawyers for Julian Assange have filed a lawsuit against the CIA and its former director, Mike Pompeo, charging they spied on U.S. lawyers and journalists who met Assange while he was living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London while in political asylum. The lawsuit is being filed as Britain prepares to extradite the WikiLeaks founder to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years in prison for violating the Espionage Act by publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with the lead attorney behind the lawsuit. Here in New York, another person has died at the Rikers Island Jail Complex, the 12th so far this year. The New York Times reports Ricardo Cruciani was found Monday morning sitting in a shower area with a sheet around his neck. The 68-year-old died about an hour later. His attorney had reportedly alerted Rikers officials to put him on suicide watch. Cruciani was a former neurologist who was convicted 2 weeks ago of sexually assaulting and raping at least 6 of his patients. And in California, thousands of unionized mental health care providers in multiple cities have gone on strike, demanding the country's largest nonprofit health care organization provide better care to people who desperately need services. Kaiser Permanente serves some 9 million people in California. According to the Union of Healthcare Workers, Kaiser has just one mental health provider for every 2,600 patients, forcing people to wait months for an appointment. Union members are also accusing Kaiser of violating treatment clinical guidelines and California state laws. The strike comes after a year of negotiations between the National Union of Healthcare Workers and Kaiser, which has rejected union proposals to expand the workforce and improve access to care. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Django Reinhardt, 1936. Of all the gin joints, what is it? How's it go? Of all the gin joints in Paris, you had to come here. Here's another one by Django with Stefan Stefanelli. One of his more famous ones, Clouds.
Thank you. Coming up, John Grant, live. Call in if you want. Area code 646-716-8652. We'll have John Grant on just after this one last musical break. You're not from Dixie. John Grant on the phone. He's in the, is it a tourist site, the Poconos? Somewhere in
Hello.
Pennsylvania. I've heard, there's a lot of funny stories about Poconos.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're mountains up in the northeast of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
They're a mountain, small mountain range, you know. And, you know, there's a lot of cabins and things. Anyway, here we are.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, what?
No, I stepped away. Did I miss your question? I don't know. What, you had a question?
Oh, just I heard that was a it's just stories about the Poconos and the Catskills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's different different levels of religious funny mm-hmm. things. You were talking, you were at a camp, mm-hmm. some sort of summer camp.
Right.
And,
well, like the Catskills, there were some, people would come up here for a weekend or something, and they were famous for their heart-shaped beds and, and I guess they had comedians and acts like the Catskills.
Yeah,
some of that. And I think that's probably less featured now, and it's now more of a sort of like a getaway. People have these houses, and Judy bought this years and years ago. And it's just beautiful out here in the woods. It takes us 2 hours to get up there. She's got this wonderful, she's got little bedrooms around, little hooches around with beds in them. And Judy was very successful with a restaurant in West Philadelphia. It was a very hip restaurant called the White Dog. And as that's for peace, we used to have dinners there and show films and speakers. And she made a ton of money, so I mean, it's a very successful. She finally sold it for a ton, and so now she's actually pretty rich. So she's got this getaway up here that's really cool.
Well, that's cool.
And now she's working for legalized weed in Pennsylvania. That's one of her interests now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Probably need to get to know John Fetterman.
Well, I'm sure she's met him, and they've talked that. Yeah, Fetterman's into the weed. So, yes, she wants a bill. It's called P33. Exactly what it means. The people of Pennsylvania is a third P. But the point is that when legalized weed comes to Pennsylvania, which seems inevitable, just a matter of time. She wants to have be assured that. They won't just give all the contracts to grow this stuff or sell this stuff to huge corporations from outside the state, that a significant element of this stuff is given to state, small growers in the state, black, African-American growers in the state and minorities and things like that. And, of course, it would allow for 10 legal plants in your backyard. Right now I have, what do I have? I have 6 in my backyard. And I guess technically they're illegal. But when this law comes in, if we can swing it, I'm going to start working with her. It'll all be legal, like it is in Maine and California and other reasonable places.
Colorado. We're next to
of course, Colorado. Absolutely,
Yeah.
Right next to Wyoming, where Lynn Cheney's going down today, from what I hear.
That's on my digital subscription to the New York Times today. Liz and Liz in Wyoming and is expected to be upset, and Sarah Palin's making a comeback in Alaska in a primary.
I heard
too,
that. Yeah.
So.
They have a ranking voting system, which I heard, which is interesting. So they would, you vote for your preferences 1, 2, 3, and they do some sort of mathematical juggling of it. And I guess then they have a runoff. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I guess it's a House seat she's running for. Is that correct?
I'll have to go back and look at the article, which I will.
Yeah, I think it's a House seat.
I just came. I snuck out while you were talking and went to a quiet place in the house because it's I just wanted to be able to hear you real clearly. I'll have to look back again and see what Sarah, dear old Sarah, is doing, the front page, the top article at the mm-hmm. Times is about the unbelievable, I'm beginning to have a very cynical attitude about Americans. I think I've had it for quite a while, but I really...
Right, I think...
The top of the... Yeah. Well, the top article, I mean, they're either subjected to deep conspiracy theories, wacko con artists for leaders, or these are American people, or they connive on how to screw anybody that has any money. I mean, the big article at the Times today is about the billions and billions and billions of dollars, thousands and thousands of cases of fraud committed during the pandemic by Americans.
Yeah,
I mean, they said it's going to take Joe Biden signed a bill extending the statute of limitations to 10 years just to allow the government to investigate all the cases of fraud.
Wow.
There was a quote from one of the guys, one of the investigators, I suppose the leader of the investigations. He says it's going to take 10 years just to get to all the cases of fraud committed.
Just for that year and a half or 2 years, whatever it was. What kind of fraud is it? What kind of fraud are they talking about?
Well, there's all these...
You mean scams and things?
Cockroach capitalists claiming they had businesses. One guy got over $30,000 on a get ready for this. A Pokemon card collection, a game card, Pokemon.
Right.
He got $30,000 plus grant for his business. Selling, he bought one Pokemon card.
Oh, right.
It was worth like $37,000. That's just one.
Yeah, right. The scam from the government payouts, you mean, right.
Yeah, there's so many. There's thousands of them.
Thousands of
scams. One guy got 30 unemployment, had 30 unemployment checks coming to him. And he became a rap musician with some money and bragged about it in the rap song. He got 30 unemployment accounts. He's collecting 30 unemployment checks each week. 30. And he did it. He made a rap song about ripping the government off.
That's pretty confident, man. That is pretty cocky, when you do that,
Yeah,
I think of all the whacked out Vietnam vets that I know who are getting 100% disability from being whacked out, who actually work against the military industrial complex that pays them.
Well, that's different. If you ask me.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course it's different. I'm just laughing. That's all.
Yeah, I know, but no, this is much worse than. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable what fraud these Americans would do. I mean, I thought.
Mm.
I discovered out here that it's almost common for farmers to go to certain accountants in the in Jefferson County, and those accountants are notorious for helping the farmers avoid paying taxes. And it's like a hobby, how to avoid paying taxes. And I was sort of pissed off about that when I discovered it, because I thought, I can understand, you're a small business, you get certain write-offs, but to make it a sport where you can go around bragging, I didn't pay any taxes, and there's potholes, gravel roads.
That's the spirit of a Donald Trump. I mean, he brags that he didn't pay any
fucking
taxes.
Fucking bridges falling apart out here. The poor people are just thrown out in a ditch, and said, get out of the county or get out of the state. Go move to Kansas City. With the rest of the trash, I mean, that's the attitude a lot of people have out here in the county. It's like if you can't make it, get here, go to the city and live under a bridge. You can't, don't live under our bridge. Go to Kansas City and live under the city.
NIMBY, not in my neighborhood, not under my bridge.
And I was just I realized they're just heartless, very heartless con artists, and I thought, God, it's a sport. It's a sport, to avoid paying taxes. And so I hear that all these tens of thousands of investigations for fraud committed when the government was handing out paycheck protection payments and Yeah. Wow. I mean, is it so far out of the realm of memory that we no longer remember Donald mm-hmm. Trump insisting that the checks are signed by his name before they go out to people? The 1400.
I think he did put his name on it somewhere. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. We used this 1400. We needed it.
Oh yeah. Well,
the 1400.
I mean, thanks a lot. We definitely.
But my God, I didn't realize people got into it, and especially these people claiming to have small businesses. I mean, that's the big ones. That's where the money. They were really ripping off the government for big money on some of those things.
Wow. I mean, you say it's on the front. I haven't seen the Times. It's on the front page of the Times today?
Yeah, top of the fold on the digital.
I'll check it out when I get home. Yeah. Well,
this tells me
one thing, notable information, is that under Joe Biden and the Democratic administration, you know, they have, hired so many thousand more IRS investigators and things?
Yeah.
And claiming to go after all this, you know, fraudulently unpaid income taxes and business taxes, et cetera. So, you know, in some sense, you know, the democratic governance systems, are turning this around. I mean, they're beginning to by doing things like that, and boldly saying they're going to raise taxes on the rich, because you remember when Mondale, you know, said that he was going to raise taxes. It was like, you know, he hit the third rail and he fried himself. So something is afoot here that, you know, the Democratic administrations can actually advocate for that, and enough people hopefully will resonate with it. So I mean, this could indicate some change, but then, of course, you get the backlash from the corporate Republican types and business types that you hear on Fox. They're just, you know, aghast and outraged that they've hired all these investigators for the IRS. Because unlike sometimes in the past, they're not going to do things like randomly audit poor people. They're going to start focusing and auditing on rich people who are not paying their fair share. So I don't know. That's an interesting situation going on anyway. Yeah.
Well, the rapper who claimed unemployment for 30 people a week and collected those checks, I mean, I don't know what he's doing. The Pokemon guy gave the card, the $37,000 card, Pokemon game card. He gave it back to the government. He gave it to the government and said, "Well, you can have the card and sell it and get the money I owe you back." I mean, I tend to think the 87,000 IRS investigators, that's what it's about.
Yeah,
but I have news for you. I have news for you, John Grant. People out here are not getting that. They don't get it. They're going, see, the goddamn Joe Biden is hiring 87,000 IRS agents, and they're coming out here, and they're going to, you know, it's like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Bobbitt, they're saying it's not just the Gestapo raiding our president, Trump, our wonderful, great orange man, but they're also
orange orangutan.
After you. They're Gestapo. Boebert and Green are calling them Gestapo, and they're coming after you now.
Of course. Yeah,
I mean, that's what you hear out here. You don't hear about how your neighbors down the road is ripping off the government on getting all this free bucks during the pandemic. You don't hear that.
Well, that's because people are locked into Fox News, and that's what they're dishing out. And of course, that's the problem. You're right. That's it. It's where, you know, we're just everybody has their little listening bubble, and you know, you don't get to hear the other stuff. Anyway,
I don't know. I don't know about that. I mean, for a lot of the old people, and the working class, the working people, they just they don't have a lot of time to get out there and look on the internet, you know, the YouTube news coverage or anything like that. And I don't think a lot of people have cable out here, really. The ones that do, you know, they have a that's a distinct bubble. I just think a lot of people, you know, they I think you're right. They select the news sources they want, and they got to have time to do any research. And I can assure you, many of them do not read the New York Times out here.
Of course not.
I mean, it's sort of interesting.
It's a demon. It's a demon. I know a lot of people that they look at me like, you read the New York Times? I do, actually, yes. And and then they don't want to talk to you anymore, you know, you're out of their bubble. And
I did not know there were so many thousands and thousands and thousands of people who committed fraud over getting money during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I did not know that. I suspected that.
Yeah.
Because I could tell.
Yeah, I don't know the extent of it. I've certainly read that. But, once the details come out, some of this stuff I see really ridiculous, like this, rapper.
It's outrageous. It's outrageous how many thousands of people willfully committed
right.
fraud, lied, filled out forms,
right.
lied about who they were. I mean, it's in the top of the fold on the Times. And I was like, God. And I suspected this when I was reading on my local county newspapers. Now, I'm a big supporter of the county newspapers, okay? But,
we don't have them here anymore. There's nothing. It's disastrous. But go ahead,
Well, these are real newspapers, and they're good newspapers.
Yeah.
But the problem is, they know. They're well aware of my criticism. I'm a former newspaper publisher. And I committed, and I said, look, everybody knows they love to have their pictures, especially of their kids and their grandkids, on the front page above the fold. There's two things you can call it. It's happy face journalism, okay?
Yeah.
Businesses always open up. They never close. There's, there's damn little poverty. You don't read about poverty.
No, certainly not.
In your county, you don't read about it. This and this church is now setting up a food pantry, or they even got different blends of food pantries. For instance, the latest one is they just put a wooden box on a pole out in a park,
Some charity
goes out and loads the box up with food, closes the door on it, and walks away. So nobody knows the poor people who is taking the food, or if they're poor, they may not even be poor, goes and takes the food out of the food box in the park.
That's the latest trend
on how to...
No, I like that idea.
No, I don't think it's cool at all, but I mean, you can
well,
think it's cool.
my wife wants me to make a little library stand on the front yard. You know, some places have there's a little,
that's
on a pole, you know, and there's like six.
That's the same shit they do. Except now they're doing.
I know. Well, my wife wants me to do that, and so I can get rid of my books. I can keep six or seven books in there, and I'll put more books in there. Plus, I can, radicalize the neighborhood by putting some of my radical books out there. I haven't done it yet. while the dog is shitting on my lawn, they could look through my little box library.
They could pull out one of your books and maybe make a conservative cry. Mm-hmm. Trump,
right, or
like
I could put some discomforts in there.
I wouldn't waste.
I brought two discomforts up for my friends here, and they've taken them home. And Judy's got one on the table here.
I've got people out here saying I need to print more of them, just for the cover. That cover was.
Oh, they like the cover. They like the cover.
Yeah, that cover was a postcard sent to me by a guy out of Texas who a guy out of Texas who called himself the Alabama. He was originally from Alabama. And it's sort of sad. He came to, when I was running newspapers in the early 1990s, he was a columnist. I called him the Missouri News in my papers.
Right.
And he would write columns for me, and I'd print the Missouri News. His name is Wendell Wentz, W-E-N-T-Z. Uh-huh. And he was in Missouri, and the only time I ever met him, he stopped by on his way. He was retiring, and he came by the printing mm-hmm. plant and to mm-hmm. say hi to me. And he said he was leaving Missouri and going to Texas. And that's the last time I ever saw him. Every few months for years, I would get these things he would mail. And he was just very much a Martin Luther King type Christian. You know, he comes from Alabama. He had firsthand knowledge. Well, he died. He sent that postcard. I printed it, enlarged it, and altered it, and put it on the front cover of Discomfit. And no shit, Wendell Wentz died after I printed that.
Oh,
isn't that something?
Well,
he was very old. I think he was 91, you know.
Well, it's a nice honor. You put his little concoction on the front. The cover there.
Yeah, but I didn't know he was dead when I printed it.
Yeah, I got you.
He died after I printed it.
Well, as far as his creation goes, he's still alive because it's on the cover. Yeah.
He might have killed him, John.
We did him in.
He was. I'm going to print a small dedication in the next time I print something about that. I sent it to his widow. He's got a widow named Mary, still lives down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I sent her a copy and a little letter and a card, you know. But, I mean, shit, what do you do about that? That's sort of awkward, wouldn't you say? I mean,
it's life, you know. You never know exactly what happens to your friends or acquaintances. They go off and, you know, as we know, none of us get out alive, so some of them may –
That's true. I mean, it's a lot.
You don't know about it.
I know. I was going down. Yeah, I've lost count of how many. It's freaky knowing people who you lived with or corresponded with, and they're gone, and it's not just one. I mean, you get to thinking about it. You go, wait a minute, that one's dead. That one's dead. That one's dead.
Well, what's really bad is every time you look at the obits now, there's more and more people younger than you are, you know.
Yeah, I'm beginning to get that. I'm reading the obituaries, and it was bad during the pandemic. I mean, I was reading people's names and their obituaries in the local newspaper. Mm-hmm. Many people who I drank coffee with, you know. And uh-huh, I know, uh-huh. I knew this guy. I was like, oh, my God, this guy's dead. So it's creepy. And now, like you said, now I find myself looking at the one. That one's 2 years younger than me. I may not know who it is, you know. But it's like, that one's younger. Ooh, that's not good. Anyhow.
Yeah, so, you know, you just, you know, keep exercising and eat right. And what are you going to do?
Oh, I don't
know. Do the best you can.
I don't
know. Well, then just you know, avoid buses so you don't get hit by a bus, you know, things like that.
Well, I do that.
I know
you don't have a lot
of buses out there where you are.
No, there's no buses. I try to smoke more cigars than I do cigarettes.
Okay.
Well, that's how I exercise. You know, more
the cigar.
More cigars, less cigarettes. That's my line. You know, dry seltzer. Hard seltzer booze, not whiskey.
Low carb
seltzer.
Right.
Yeah, don't you have that in Pennsylvania? Probably not. You don't have any.
What? Seltzer?
Do you?
What?
Yeah, hard seltzer.
Well, yeah,
hard
I mean, to me, hard seltzer is the next step beyond light beer, you know. I mean, light beer gets to the point, you know. What's the difference between the lightest beer and a seltzer, hard seltzer? I don't know. It gets to the point there's probably not a lot of difference between the two. But anyway, I don't particularly like light beer, so I guess that's my prejudice.
No, I imagine you don't.
That doesn't matter.
I had to come back into the noise room. The audio quality is bad. I'm sorry. So why don't you give us a 10-minute give us a 10-minute summation of the raid on the Tangerine Man, Donald Trump.
Oh,
what do you think
what
raid?
I know of it. Certainly what I know of it is, what was that, a week ago now or what? Yeah. And the big question is, you know, we all, I mean, there's six things, legal issues he's got within Georgia, New York, New York City, New York State, Washington, et cetera, federal government. You know, we heard that his house was, raided, his term, by the FBI. So where everybody was like, oh, what is it all about? Well, it turns out the claim is, but of course the search warrant was open. In other words, the search warrant was focused particularly on, secret documents that presumably the ex-president had taken and acquired somewhere down in the basement of Mar-a-Lago or something, and gave some of them up, but apparently they got some inside information from somebody that he was still squirreling away some. And so they took the opportunity. They got a federal magistrate judge to sign it. And they went in and did it very delicately with no FBI shirts or anything. And he was out of town. And he'd already gotten a subpoena for that stuff and he wasn't delivering it. So they then went to search, warrant realm. So what it seems, since their search warrant is open and they could, in other words, if they found documents saying he was guilty of other crimes, they had the authority under that search warrant to abscond with those documents and hold them as evidence for other crimes rather than holding secret documents and things. So whether the raid was just specifically for this national security material that they wanted to secure and get away from his cellar or whatever, because it's vulnerable there, or that whether it was just that or whether it was just sort of an open-ended thing in order to establish the federal government's attorney general, FBI's absolute, right under the Constitution to, have a search warrant and raid the ex-president's house. In other words, they have established a precedent here. Federal government can, break into this guy's house, even though he was the ex-president of the United States. So that's a major deal. That's a major hurdle for the federal government, because this is an absolute first. This has never happened before. In what, 230 years or something of this government. How much of that is specifically for this one issue of documents and how much of it is, to, again, set the precedent that you are not above the law, pal, you orange-haired orangutan. You're not above the law. Kind of that's where it is. There's all kinds of huge questions, many questions. Nobody really knows what it's about because they keep their cards close to the vest, and that's where we're at. So what do you think? It's all public.
It's hard to really know.
Chewing it around.
Because I think it's hard to really know because...
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, I was talking to a buddy of mine last night on the phone. And he said, the big hot item is, of course, it's Donnie saying they took my passports. They took my passports.
Did they?
I
didn't know that. Did they take his passports?
Well, we don't
know.
That's what he says.
Oh, that's what he says. Okay.
Somebody said, well, one was a diplomatic passport, one was a passport that was expired, and then there was a current passport that he has. But, nobody really knows. see, and you're going,
exactly,
wow. See, I went, wow. I went, wow.
Yeah.
But then I talked to my friend,
mm-hmm,
and he reminded me. He reminded me, mm-hmm, he says, but you got to remember, this is Donnie telling his,
right,
followers this. The walls,
right,
are closing in. Get your guns.
Right.
Let's do something.
Exactly.
Talk to
true.
Them.
Well, true. That's the only play they have, you know, yeah. But, you know, it seems that this raid, I don't know. It has so many questions, like you say. We just don't know. And so there's a lot of speculation. We don't, you know, really know why they did it. And, when, of course, the next question is, when's the next shoe going to drop? You know, are they going to raid some, you know, the Bedminster Club or, you know, whatever? And but if it's true that they took his passports, that's real, you know, police activity with, you know, criminals that you think may flee the country, you know, and go to some non-extradition sort of place, right? You know, Saudi Arabia or something. They can, you know, offer, you know, Mohammed bin Salman can offer, a palace, you know, just a minor palace, of course, over there in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
You know,
right.
And he might be out of extradition. And so, you know, it's a standard procedure for them to take their passports so they cannot, you know, get through customs and things like that. If they did that, that's a major deal, I think, yeah. I mean, they're actually saying this man is a criminal hazard, you know, and he could flee. In other words, if this is a, you know, a shot across his bow and he begins to realize he's got five other cases around him, you know, the law of averages, one of them is going to stick, you know, like you throw the shit at the wall, one of them is going to stick. And so he may be running really scared, which I think would be justified, because he should be. He's a goddamn criminal, in my view. But who am I? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
So I'm delighted with, you know, this quote, wimpy guy, Merrick Garland, really pulled a fast one on Trump. If you sort of look at how it worked, you know, they did this thing, and all of a sudden, the first thing, all of his clown show, clown car guys and House and Senate and whatnot, all said, oh, this is an outrage. You need to release the document. You're hiding this document. You release the search warrant so that we can see how outrageous your raid was. You know, you're hiding this. And then it filtered out. All the journalists said, well, you know, Donald Trump was given a Xerox copy of the, you know, the warrant, search warrant, and the subpoena. And he was given a Xerox copy of what they took, itemized what they took. So why are your clown car guys going aghast that the federal government is not releasing a document when it's up to the Donald Trump to release it himself? I mean, he had it. He had the ability, the power to release it. And he at first chose not to. He hid the fact that he had it. And so once they were all on record as like the outrage, oh, the feds are not revealing the documents. Oh, this is just the excess of power and outrage and it's tyranny and all this. Then, you know, nice, soft, mellow Garland comes up to a mic and he tells everybody this. He says, hey, you know, we are now applying to a judge to have this stuff released tomorrow. Could have released it yesterday, you know, and we're going to, you know, because everybody's curious, we're not hiding it, you know, we'll release it tomorrow. And of course, in the process, we're going to ask Donald Trump and his lawyers if they would prefer that the feds did not release this. And, of course, it was a coup, and everybody knew that, you know, Donald had been caught in a trap by this guy, Merrick Garland and company. And so then they had to say, well, shit, release it. We don't care. And so that's where it is. You know, so it's a game. They're playing this game, and the feds are in on the game. And it was a public relations move. I mean, this was not an illegal system move. This was you know, playing game in the news and public relations channels, you know, about, you know, this document and, you know, Cruz and all these people saying, oh, the government is unfair, they're tyrannical, they're not releasing this. Well, it was all just a fart in a bottle, you know. It just was nothing. And then, you know, they had a little egg in their face, I thought. So Garland did it brilliantly. That's my understanding. And I think, you know, all of them understand. They understand this guy could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. You know, two impeachments that didn't get anywhere, no traction. So you have to work this guy really strategically. And I think that's what they're doing. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. Yeah.
Well, they did this. They defund Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Bobbitt, the two crazies, says
right.
Defund the FBI. Now that's, I mean, what is it? I mean, they graft them, these things on.
I love it.
They take
I love it.
Defund the FBI. I mean,
Well, you know, this reminds me of the backlash of, you know, right-wing people when they start, you know, they start accusing the left of exactly what you're accusing them of, you know, and all this kind of stuff. That reminds me of when we were protesting at Westchester with all these right-wingers and we had some vets and they, you know, the whole idea was, you know, baby killers that, you know, anti-war people in the 60s called soldiers in Vietnam baby killers, right? Baby killers, you know. And so it got so bad, we had the one vet, he was giving a woman a really, really hard time. And she turned on him and she started screaming, baby killer, baby killer. And we're going like, what? What is she saying? You know,
right.
It's usually the other way around. You know, it's the left calling the right baby killers. And here's the right wing calling this great anti-war vet who, you know, turned against his experience in Vietnam of killing people and calling him a baby killer. I mean, it was just like, what? Boy, the audacity of these people. It's incredible. And then at that point you learn, and I learned this during that year we spent every Saturday nose to nose with these people, that you can't use logic with them. You can't use logic. You have to just stand up, push your chest out, and, you know, meet them nose to nose. And then they respect you. Got to the one point, I was up on this, behind the statue, in front of the statue, and we had signs, and there were some of these yahoos behind us. And this one guy was calling, ah, you faggots, muttering behind us, calling us faggots and all this kind of stuff. And I turned around and I said, why don't you fucking pansies just shut up? And I turned around. It was like, what? One of these leftists actually said something like that, you know? And you know, after that, they respect you, ironically enough. And the other time was I went up and I said, some guy was talking to one of my friends, and I said something, and he looked right in the face and he said, fuck you. And I was a little taken aback. And then I said, no, fuck you too, you know? And he said, fuck you twice. And I said, look, fuck you three times and I'm ready to go up to 15. So let's go, you know? It's like, and it was, and the guy laughed. He laughed. And at that point, you know,
you
reach another level of talking to people like that, you know, because you realize the language is just empty and stupid, you know. But anyway, that's a little distraction there. You know?
Well, do you think, well, I mean, out here, you know, the big victory was the not changing the state constitution to outlaw abortion. Okay, that was a big thing. And
it still resonates around the country. People talk about it here all the time.
Well, look, people are talking, it seems like every time there's an election, there mm-hmm. people are talking. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's this thing, even though Donnie in 2016, or should I say 2016, mm-hmm. Donnie Trump, Kellyanne Conway, Steve
right.
Bannon,
mm-hmm.
what's her name, the daughter of Mercer, the billionaire, I mean,
oh, right,
they all
right,
came
right,
in
yeah,
late.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they came in
mm-hmm.
late summer of 2016
mm-hmm.
and took over Donnie's campaign, used
mm-hmm.
computer data to decide
mm-hmm.
which were the five the swing states, the so-called battleground states, and using data, Mercer, that's
mm-hmm.
Mercer, Robert Mercer's forte as a billionaire on the stock
right.
market. They used that data, and Steve Bannon and Conway and others convinced Donnie to throw shit tons of money into certain districts and counties in these
yeah.
battlegrounds, and he won. He won by a
yeah.
very,
yeah.
very
yeah.
slim margin in 2016. And then
right.
it only took the country and the so-called liberal media, you know,
mm-hmm.
to hound old Donnie down, like hunt him down like a dog, okay, and bring
yeah.
and reveal all the dirty, sordid shit that he got away
yeah.
with in a past life, and then as president,
yeah.
and
yeah.
a wave of 7 million, the largest number of people to ever vote in the history of the United States comes out on both sides, and 7
yeah.
million more came
mm-hmm.
out against Donnie than the other side. And
yeah.
look at the aftermath. I mean, the January
6th, oh, yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
sore loser.
Boy, it wasn't even close.
Pissed off.
And, they, you know, they prepped for this idea of it's stolen. You know, it's ridiculous, you know. They're the ones doing corrupt electioneering and, you know, campaigning and voting and whatnot. And yet, again, this is their pattern. They then project that onto you, the Democrats in this case, as they're the ones stealing the election, and you're going like, wow, again, well, these people have incredible audacity. Who do they think they are? You know what I mean? Just because they have guns, they think they own it. And,
yeah.
As my wife said the other day in a moment of weakness, she said, okay, if you want civil war, bring it the fuck on. Let's do it. You know, okay, some of us are going to buy the farm, you know, like in any war. But, you know, in the end, you know, if it takes, you know, if you're nothing but a collective bunch of lunatics like this guy that went to, the FBI in Minnesota or Minneapolis, where the hell, in the Midwest somewhere. Remember, the guy went and he had a nail gun. He had an AR-15, a loaded AR-15, Cincinnati, a loaded AR-15,
Cincinnati.
And a nail gun. And so he goes into the place. And he's shooting at the secretaries and everybody with the nail gun, which is, you know, can really hurt you, but, you know, it's not like the AR-15 is going to kill you. I'm hearing beeps. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I can
hear you. Good. I'm sorry. So he, you know, what's with him? And then, I mean, you know, as an assassin or a shooter or whatever you want to call this clown, he's a total, utter failure. Because, what, he lost his nerve or what, you know? I mean, so if this is what civil war is about, I'm not worried, you know? Although, you know, elements of January 6th would make you a fool not to be too concerned and cautious and wary of, you know, these folks. But, I mean, I think that guy is an example. It's pathetic, don't you? I mean, it's like, geez. I mean,
well,
you can't even get it together as an absurd, irrational, lunatic shooter, you know? I mean, God.
They show up in Phoenix in full battle, dressed up for battle, outside the FBI building in Phoenix, Arizona. They show up with their guns. And
then
another guy drives smack down Pennsylvania Avenue into a barricade,
mm-hmm.
sets his car
mm-hmm.
on fire, then accidentally sets himself on fire, and he walks down towards the Congress on Pennsylvania and then blows his own brains out.
Flies on this fire. This was what, a couple of months ago or something? What was it?
Oh, all these happened in the last week, John.
Oh, really? I've been a little out of it, I guess. Yeah. Well,
you've been on the Poconos.
Yeah, I've been
long.
In the Poconos. I've been a Pocono retreat up here. But all of those ended only in the capture or the death of the lunatic. Am I correct? I mean, there was no real gun battle anywhere.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think they not ever getting ready to kill him, but I mean, he ended up shooting himself after he set his own car on fire and then accidentally set himself on fire. He walked Burning Man. He went Burning Man. And then shot himself.
Even January 6th, I watched the thing live, and I've seen, thousands of images afterwards. And we're been told that some of those folks had guns. They had weapons, loaded lethal weapons. And Donald Trump wanted them brought into the action. He said they're not, he publicly said to his people that, they're not here to hurt me, so I don't care if they have guns. Let them go into the Congress with their guns. He didn't care. And so what's interesting to me is there was not a gun battle during January 6th. Granted, they did shoot that one woman, and I think the person who shot her was absolutely justified. She was coming right in that window into the house itself or whatever building, chambers it was. And that stopped them. So, unfortunately, she took the bullet. But that's it. Other people died for suicides the next day or lethal issues and whatnot. Somebody was trampled in the crowd. But no guns came out on either side. And I think that's because both sides understood that, the fetish and fear and, craziness of guns in America, if guns came out and there was exchange of gunfire, it would have been a bloody massacre. You know what I mean? In some way, people would have been shooting crazy, and it would. And I think everybody, including the demonstrators or the insurgents, whatever you want to call them, they were restrained, which is probably good, So that restraint, at what point do they say, screw it to that restraint and just, go into, suicide by cop sort of mode? And, because the federal government is not going to be put down by, some militia of 35 people. They're going to bring in the 82nd Airborne ultimately, and they're going to put this thing down. That's just the way it is. The United States does not lose these things. That was the truth with the cops. When I used to interview the cops and under Frank Rizzo when I was in Newsweek, I'd go, and they'd tell me, the idea we're the biggest gang in town, we can never lose. The police department can never lose. So they will escalate to meet whatever comes at them. And the cops were convincing me, this liberal kid, a reporter, of this. Look, we don't lose. We do what we have to do, And then, as the point out, we hire the best gangster lawyer in town to protect our cops, And this is how it works. I think that would work, against these right-wing militias. I don't know. What do you think? You think I'm not?
Well, I know that they're sore losers. They're sore losers. Here in Kansas, when this thing went down on changing the Constitution to outlaw abortion, and that's what it was about. They used every sneaky trick in the bag they could come up with to get it to this far. And then it is defeated by over 20% of the vote, okay? What has happened since then is they've got some woman on TikTok. You heard of TikTok, John?
Sure, of course.
Heard of
yeah.
Okay.
I've heard of it, but I certainly do not know my way around TikTok.
Yeah, I know. I stopped at Facebook and Twitter. Fuck it. I'm not
I can barely handle Facebook.
Right.
Or email.
Email, right. Yeah. That makes us old, I guess. But this young girl.
I think that makes us old.
Yeah. But this young woman, I actually call her a woman. This young woman gets on TikTok and she says, "We need to recount, and I'm praying to God that we can raise the money, so we can have a hand recount of the Kansas vote." And she's a crazy Christian, and guess what? She needed to raise she needed to raise over $300,000, but she couldn't get that. So they some guy hawked off his house. By the way, a guy who used to hang out at the the abortion clinics in Wichita. He was a real stalker. I'm not going to say his name, but he's going to put his house up on mortgage or something. He's going to get a bunch of money. And they came up with a little over $100,000, which is enough to do a hand recount of the largest counties. But what this does, and they're repeating, they're repeating in the news media, they're repeating the same thing about voter fraud, people cheating, and you know, the same thing from after the last presidential election.
But you know, the whole narrative of this thing, that is, in other words, there's so, this right wing element that the example you're bringing and others, they're so afraid of losing because they look at democracy. If it works, you know, there are more people because of, you know, greed and things that have created the distance between the rich and the poor. You know, they're getting to the point there are more people who are sympathetic to, you know, a bottom-up kind of structure, you know, a good balance of capitalism and socialism, you know, that makes a society really hum, you know, for everybody. And, of course, that's the struggle, you know, these days. And you know, so democracy, they know, like the vote that just kind of surprised everybody in Kansas, you know, it's like, how do you respond to that? You'll have to change your ideas, like accept, you know, a reasonable abortion program, you know, that covers bases and, you know, everybody's got a little bit of investment in it. Versus an absolute thing, you know, in which there's no way they're ever going to sustain that except through tyrannical means and dishonest means and that sort of thing, you know, calling all elections that they lose fraudulent, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's where we are. And that's the game for these next two elections. And it's, to me, the question is it going to prevail? You know, that tyranny will trump, pun intended, democracy, you know? And on that note, I hear the music creeping up.
John Grant.
Okay, Mike, take care out there.